And then we have the Executive Secretary Barry on the line. So I'm just going to call this meeting to order. You should have all gotten the board pack on Friday. So we've had plenty of time to review the things that we need to approve. So I'm just going to get into the routine business. We had minutes that were sent for our last meeting on the 15th. Any questions about the minutes?
This is Doug. I looked at them, and they're as I remember, so I will move the adoption of the minutes.
This is Josh. I will second, although I do have a quick question. Are we, if we're required to keep minutes, I think that that makes sense, but given that the recordings are made available, is there a need to do that?
I think that's a good question.
My understanding is that there is no absolute legal need to keep a printed, abbreviated version, but for practical purposes, the board had done that in the past.
To the extent that the board thinks it's useful to have them, either to the board or to the public, I think it makes sense to keep them. But to the extent it's not, then we don't want. And there's no requirement, then I'd be fine with eliminating them also. I was just sort of curious about the rationale behind it.
This is Doug. It's a good question. I haven't thought about that. Maybe Jonathan can elucidate.
Yeah, let me take a try at that. For example, today, later on in this meeting, we're going to be taking up the policies that were adopted by a previous board. It'd be very hard to research policies that were adopted if we had to go through all the recorded minutes of the meeting, and so the abbreviated version often comes in quite handy.
Okay. Well, then I would say go ahead and do it, Josh. Okay with you?
Yeah. If the staff at BCPL thinks that it's valuable to have them, I think it makes sense to keep them. I just wanted to ask.
I mean, I will be honest. I also think that the written ones have been helpful. I mean, I know when I've looked through in the past, it's just it's easier to kind of review things.
I agree.
So the motion is still on the table to, I guess, approve the minutes. Is there a second?
We already got one.
Great. All right. So we've approved the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Great. Opposed?
Your voice.
Oh, yeah, did I? Okay. Yep. all right. Moving on to approval of the loans. Rich, do you want to go through these with us?
Sure. There are six loans for review totaling about $1.5 million, and they have been approved for public purpose by the Attorney General's office.
So just, I guess, two questions on public purpose. For TOMA, do we know anything about the business loan at all?
I do. I believe it's for a warehouse distribution project located within a TID district.
Yeah, but this is Doug. I looked at them and they seem normal, so I'll make a motion to approve the six loans.
Yeah, and then I guess just my second question as we're looking up that, Rich, was finance, operations, and maintenance. Is that normal for a community to be asking for operation-type loans?
Just to be picky, we should get a second before we discuss them.
Oh, is there a second?
A second.
Great. Thank you.
To answer your question, it is relatively unusual for communities to borrow for operations. I did talk to the Village of Whiting, and they just used the operations as a general term. They're actually being the loan is actually being used for street repairs and for constructing a fence. But they had one item within the loan that was for, I believe, subsidizing some bus fares for village residents, and so that's why they use the word operations. But it is relatively rare. You know, we get a handful of them on an annual basis, but not very often.
Okay.
have a question too. What is the basis for the different repayment rates? Does it have to do with the different bond ratings, or is there something else?
No, it's only term. We set our rates based on the length of the loan. Because we have the statutory ability to intercept state aid in case of a loan default, we believe that the credit quality of all the loans is very similar.
So if you notice, the rates that are of the shortest term are at 4.25%. The medium-term ones are 4.5%, and the long-term ones are 4.75%.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
Any other questions about the loans? One point of information. Based on our last meeting, I know something that we want to work on moving forward is making sure that we are sharing with the community that they know about sometimes the resources that we're providing. And so I don't know if there's any that when we look at these five that we are providing for these five communities, if there's one that maybe is worth highlighting based on the need and the purpose and the interest. So I guess I throw that out to the staff as we think about this and as we move potentially to approve. Is that something for us to also think about, is reaching out to these communities and letting the citizens of these communities know about the benefit that we're providing them?
In terms of
this is Doug. We, as you know from the last meeting, we historically send out a press release to the local papers in every community. I don't know what else we could do. We haven't tried to reach out to radio stations. There's usually a small radio station in every community. I guess we could have Jonathan or someone call them and give them a little voice message they could play.
I mean, the reason why I ask this is that I think sometimes the blanket approach isn't effective, that we just send it out to everybody. I think that, you know, my just experience with the local community outreach opportunities is that you need to target them. And so while I think we do a general press release, that's helpful, but I think sometimes when we need to think through what might be worthwhile to reach out to specific communities and doing more targeted outreach. And so that's why I'm just asking with this specific list, is there someone that's worth targeting that we can maybe spend a little bit more time reaching out to and elevating and sharing the awareness of the value that we're providing?
The thing that's interesting about TOMA here, they're taking out three different loans, and what they're doing is they're taking our loan program and they're using it to target individual local efforts on different topics. And so while there are some people in the legislature that are very much against allowing communities to take our loans and pass them through to local entities, TOMA is taking the opposite approach and saying, we like that opportunity to be able to take your loans and pass them through, because it gives us the power then to help these local efforts quite a bit. And so, yeah, this would be an interesting opportunity to highlight a community using it for that very purpose.
Because we're almost, and the reason why I ask is we're almost providing $1.3 million to TOMA for a small business, for economic development, and for veterans, which are pretty big topics. And these are things that people have asked for assistance with. We know that they are challenges that communities face, and we are, I think, are providing a great service by allowing them the ability to do these kind of projects. And so I do think it might be worthwhile then to reach out specifically to TOMA in that area, advocating about the work that we're doing.
Well, this is Vicki. Can I speak to the press releases we send out?
Yeah.
So I send a general press release to, like, the internet newspaper, shall we say, or internet outlets. But then for each one of these individual communities, I do send a targeted press release that states that a loan is approved for this municipality and the dollar amount and the purpose, but then they also see the full list of all the loans that were approved too. So there are targeted press releases sent to those local newspapers.
Yes, exactly. If you don't, and what do you guys think about my idea of calling the radio station? Is that something that you'd like to do, Jonathan? Or is that something that we should allow our state treasurer to do that? Now, you could obviously do that if you wanted, Sarah.
Doug, on many occasions, either myself or Tom will receive a phone call from a local radio station that's precipitated by the press release that we have sent out, asking for more detail. On some of the larger issues that really have some sizzle, if you will, I can say that phrase, we will initiate a call to radio stations, but we don't have a large vocabulary of radio stations that seem interested in reporting this. It's kind of confined to the larger communities.
Well, it's my experience, which is somewhat historic, I admit, that most of these stations, if you call them and have something that relates to their community, they're pretty excited about it, and they say, can I turn on a tape recorder and ask you a couple questions? So I think Jonathan could try that, or Sarah, you could try that, or Joel, you're welcome to try it. But Sarah might find it interesting.
So here's just my thought, and I don't know if this needs to be formally approved or not, but maybe we can talk offline about our outreach strategy and making sure that, you know, constituents of the great state of Wisconsin know about the services that we're providing. I do think that it would be valuable that we hit all mediums, not just when it's relevant, not just newspapers, but I do think radio and even their local television stations. I mean, I think we've got to be more robust in our outreach strategies and letting citizens know about this. So if it's okay with the board, I don't think this needs to be an official kind of agenda item. I just wanted to bring this up for discussion, but if it's okay with the board, I can move forward with this and kind of and improving our outreach strategy with the BCPL team here.
Well, this is Doug. It's okay with me. I mean, I suggested a minute ago that we either ask Jonathan to do it, or if Sarah would like to do it, you can try calling radio stations and the television. I mean, every community has a television, whether it's Eau Claire or La Crosse or Walsall or Milwaukee or Green Bay. They all listen to some radio television, and you could call them as well.
Yeah, I think that's... Again, sorry guys, we're back out. I'm happy actually to move forward with that if that works for the group.
Well, yeah, this is Doug again. I suggest we give it a try. In fact, if what they're doing, and you can look at the loans and the Tulsa example today was a good one, if what's going on seems kind of special, and if you call the radio and even the TV and say, we loaned this money to this school or this village for this exciting thing they're doing, the TV people might really get into that, and they might even want to interview someone about it, and they could always have their Madison affiliate could come to the basement and find Sarah, for example, and ask her to explain why this is such an exciting thing that, quote, Tulsa is doing. So we'll go ahead and give it a try and then give us a report.
Okay. All right, so if that's okay with the group, then I guess we can just move forward with approving the loans because I'm just sensitive to about time. So all those in favor of approving the loans listed, say aye.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Josh.
Okay, hi, Sarah. So the loans are approved. Great. Okay, so moving on to new business, one of the things that we asked as a board was to look at previous policies that the last board had adopted during the 2015 to 2018 term. The BCPL team here pulled five current policies that were enacted over those 4 years. And so I think, you know, for the purpose of today, is to kind of discuss some of these policies and decide, you know, do we want to amend, repeal, ratify, or quite frankly, if we want to kind of have a parking lot and maybe come back to it at another meeting, I think that is also fine. But I do think it's
okay,
important.
Okay, this is Doug. I looked at the five of them some time ago, and then this morning I reviewed them again, and just very briefly, I'm not making this as a lot of static for some reason, is that the first three sort of seem okay to me. I see no problem with those. It keeps the commissioners apprised of things. But the last two I have trouble with, and depending on your Josh and Sarah's feeling, I would make a motion to repeal the fourth and fifth item on that agenda. And so if someone would like to second that, we can discuss that.
This is Josh. I would like to discuss them. I'm not sure I'm ready to move forward on some of them. Are we able to, pursuant to Robert's rules, have a discussion about them?
Yeah.
Without a motion?
I agree, Josh. So maybe let's start from the bottom off if that works for everybody. So the first policy, moving from the bottom, is to decline acceptance of state trust fund loan applications for school energy efficiency projects and for the remainder of 2017. I know that there is actually some history on this one, so I don't know if Jonathan, Tom, or Rich, if you want to chime in and share.
So just to be clear, what are we doing? Do I need to withdraw my motion? I'm confused.
Yeah, so I guess do you want to withdraw your motion for us, Doug? Is that okay?
Okay, if you like, I'll withdraw my motion.
Thank you. So now we're moving into. Yep.
Go ahead. This is Jonathan. Taking the last item, that one is moot because the legislature subsequently passed legislation that eliminates school energy efficiency projects without a referendum. It really isn't current anymore.
I understand.
By way of explanation.
So, Jonathan,
do you want me to discuss any of these?
So, Jonathan, I think if we can go through these one by one, I think that just might be easier. And as we're kind of driving this train, I want to make it as efficient as possible. So, Jonathan, just to kind of make sure I'm understanding what you're saying is that we can repeal this, but there is already some legislation in place that kind of mirrors this, that basically says school energy efficiency projects cannot receive any sort of financing. Is that correct?
No, they can't. They can receive financing, but they're not any longer. They must also have a referendum. Correct, Tom?
Yes. What happened was in the last budget, I believe that the governor used a line item veto to address schools that were using a different process for approving energy efficiency loans. And by using the line item veto, what he ended up creating was a 100-year blackout period is about the best way to put it, or a 1,000-year blackout period, so that, in essence, schools could not use that alternate process for approving those loans. But the board adopted kind of a more blanket approach to not accepting energy efficiency loan applications for the rest of 17, whether or not they had gone through the referendum process or the alternate process. But that board policy did have a sunset of the end of 2017. So.
Oh.
And this is Doug. I would still decide that we should just repeal that to get rid of it, so it's no longer the policy of the board to consider that.
This is Jonathan. Repealing it would have no effect, and it's fine to repeal it.
I understand.
Yeah, but there's nothing to repeal, right?
So There is something to repeal because it's still on the books as a policy, but I guess what Jonathan's saying is it doesn't really necessarily matter. I think it's more just making a statement that we don't necessarily view energy efficiency as a bad thing. So I think by repealing it, it's more of a kind of value statement on behalf of the board, if anything else.
And this is Doug. And I was there when it happened, and we had a lot of discussion, and I won't bore you with it. But the reason I would like to repeat it is to make such a statement. And I voted against it when it was passed.
But this is Josh. Just to be clear, so currently we do not have a policy in effect that stops these loans from being submitted. But also, the state government does prevent schools from having such loans. Is that right?
Right. The statutes at this point in time would require a school district, if they were going to get an energy efficiency loan, of a certain amount.
Of longer than 10 years.
Of longer than 10 years to go through a referendum process. Like I said, what happened in 2017 is the board adopted just a blanket prohibition. The policy that was adopted didn't care how the school district had approved it. Even if it had gone to referendum, we were prevented from accepting those. So I look at it as there's two different routes, well, three different things you could do. You could just say, well, that's passed. We don't have to worry about that. Two, you could repeal it. Or three, the board could just adopt a statement that they, that the board feels that any energy efficiency loan applications in the future would be treated the same as any other loan applications, and we would welcome them. So,
I'm fine with the third option, but I don't want to tell people we're accepting loan applications if there are state law that would require a referendum. So I just want to be clear if we're saying something that we're advising, mm-hmm. that the advice we're putting out is consistent with whatever the
law.
Correct.
Exactly.
Like I said, the alternate route of approving those longer term energy efficiency loans was taken away by the line item veto. But all other methods of approving those energy efficiency loans still remain in effect for school districts.
This is Doug. I sort of like Tom's question there, and I won't make a motion yet, but I would be open to making a motion that we say that the board is open to receiving loan applications for alternate energy projects. I think that's maybe a good way to deal with this. If the two of you agree, we could do that.
Yeah, and I think the motion is something like, the state trust fund loan program will accept applications for school energy efficiency programs
in accordance
with state law. Exactly. I think that's exactly what the amendment could be.
Right. Shall I try to word that? Shall I go ahead and do that?
And just to be clear, so if a referendum were required for it before the loan was issued, we would first insist that there be a referendum, right?
Correct.
Correct.
That makes sense to me. I'm happy either to take a vote on that now or for somebody to propose language, and we can vote on it at the next meeting.
Josh, it's Jonathan. Would you like our staff to us to prepare language and circulate it for your consideration for the next meeting?
So I think this is Sarah. I think this is actually a quick win. Let's just amend it right here on the spot, and I'm happy to propose that. So the amendment would
That's
read
fine.
To can somebody, put their phone on mute? We're just getting some background noise. Is that the state trust fund loan program will accept applications for school energy efficiency projects in accordance with state law.
Okay, this is Doug. My little suggestion would be to say energy efficiency and alternative energy, because the two are different. Energy efficiency and alternative energy.
Doug, I accept your friendly amendment.
I second.
So all those in favor of the statute as amended, the policy as amended, say aye.
Yeah, this is Doug. I vote aye. Yes.
Aye, Josh.
Aye, Sarah. Great. So the amended policy is passed. Moving to the second policy is agency staff are prohibited from engaging in global warming or climate change policy advocacy during BCPL time.
And again, this is Doug, as you could hear earlier, and as you can probably assume, I was involved in that insanity, and I voted no on that as well. So I would very much like to have the support to repeal that one. But I won't make a motion yet, so you two can talk for a while if you like.
This is Josh. So I guess I have a couple questions. I guess I'm wondering, putting aside the specific issue of climate change, what are the situations in which BCPL would be doing policy advocacy generally? Because to the extent that that policy advocacy is required for BCPL purposes, that, you know, I think that makes perfect sense. But, you know, to the extent that it's not, I mean, obviously we need whatever policy advocacy is being done to relate to a clear BCPL. So I'm just curious how that's come up before.
Josh, this is Jonathan. There are occasions, primarily with the forestry issues, where our foresters are trying to accommodate what they perceive and what their experts are telling them may be effects of climate change as it relates to pest attacks on trees and whatnot. So they develop from time to time strategies to mitigate what they perceive to be changing climate.
And this is Doug. For example, if there was some activity to do something about climate disruption by the legislature or by the DNR or whatever, and we felt that it would have some impact on our programs, probably the forestry, for example, I think it would be okay for Jonathan or Tom to speak out about that and say XYZ policy would be detrimental, da da da. So I think that we should allow our staff, including Jonathan and Tom and others, to address those issues if appropriate.
So this is Sarah. I'm just going to chime in about this. Here's my overall thought is that, you know, the BCPL staff work on behalf of the board to ensure that we benefit our schools through good trust fund management and good land management practices, right? So everything that we are doing, and I would hope that staff is advocating for, the board is well aware of, their proposals that we've talked about, it's in the know. I'm concerned that if we get down this slippery slope like they did in 2015, that we are, you know, excluding Y and excluding Z, I think that that's a level of patrolling that's just unnecessary and not valuable. Because at the end of the day, we know exactly what's happening. We talk about these policies in these meetings. We talk about the benefits, and that's what we should be advocating for, whether it's with state legislators, the governor's office, or with key benefactors. So I don't know why this one is exclusive. I think that we could talk about this all day, but I don't know necessarily the value that we start calling out explicit reasons or justifications, since this is the only exception right now, and I just don't think that's necessarily or adds value.
So just to follow up on a quick point, so if, for example, if there were legislation proposed that might have an impact on trust assets, because it would contribute to climate change, for example, or reduce efforts to address climate change. Under the current policy, there's a prohibition on having agency staff even point out that one of the consequences of proposed legislation would be that the value of trust assets would potentially be affected. Is that right?
I believe that's the effect of the current policy.
Okay. So I
And this is Doug, and that's exactly why it was a crazy idea, and I voted against it, and I would like us to repeal it.
So, yeah, so this is Josh. I mean, my view is that, you know, anytime the board is weighing in on policy, it should have to do directly with BCPL interests. But I agree with you, Sarah, that there's no reason to have a policy that's specific to one type of advocacy, and that it should be a policy that's consistent across the board. And by repealing this rule, would we go back to having a policy that's consistent across the board?
Yes. The staff will always try to make sure that we are staying within the policy guidelines set by the board. We do not try to get out over our skis. But as the Attorney General pointed out, there are times that we are asked, you know, how does this play out? What methods are needed to respond to these particular conditions?
I completely agree with Tom on that statement, and we're very comfortable with repealing this. And as a staff, we will not be cutting new ground ahead of our board. That's not our prerogative.
So,
okay, well, at this point, in order to expedite things, I am going to make a motion that we repeal item number 4 on this list.
I second.
All right, so the motion on the floor is to repeal that agency staff are prohibited from engaging in global warming or climate change policy advocacy during BCPL time. All those in favor say aye.
We didn't discuss it officially, but I vote aye.
I vote aye as well.
Great. I vote aye as well, so the motion has been passed. Yeah, Doug, I thought that we had good discussion. I will make sure to always chime in. I'm just trying to be efficient in my Robert's rules, but agreed. Okay, so moving on to the third item, which is the board chair shall approve agency expenditures over $5,000 other than payroll and fixed obligation expenses, and a report will be provided to the board at their next meeting.
Again, this is Doug. I don't see any real harm in that. I mean, it sort of indicates that we don't trust our staff. On the other hand, it allows the commissioners to have more total knowledge of what's going on because we're all busy. And this way we would hear about these things and find out what they are.
Does this create issues for the staff?
The issue that's created is because the policy was drafted so broadly that there are times it's hard to figure out from our standpoint, is this a continuing obligation, fixed obligation, or is this something new? For example, we have a subscription to Bloomberg News Service. Well, Bloomberg News Service costs more than $5,000 a year. Does that fall within that purview that we have to report that every time that comes in? Or is that something that, it's approved once and it's done? So, again, what it was an inartful drafting that created a bit of vagueness for the staff to interpret. Does this fall within that or not? So,
here's a suggestion, and obviously subject to the other commissioners' views, but I tend to agree with Doug that, in general, you know, having approval if it's not something that's a recurring expense like you're talking about makes sense. But I also think if there's a way that the policy can be drafted so it's clear, I think it's certainly worth looking at that.
Josh, this is Jonathan. I have no problem with the reporting of 5,000, but I think Tom's making a point. It would be helpful if we just included the word and non-recurring, meaning that it was something unusual. Because reporting to the chair is just reasonable. We tend to tell the chair everything is going on to the point of boring he or she. But I think it's a reasonable restriction on us if you add that caveat.
Josh, this is Sarah.
This is Doug. The reason I like it a little bit, and I've lived with it, I see, is the fact that the report will be provided at the next meeting. So to me, asking the chair's opinion is sort of the least important part of it. The important part is at the next meeting, we hear about it, so we know what's going on.
So this is Sarah. I guess my question, and Josh, I don't know what you... I'm curious, do you have policies like this in DOJ? Because in my previous work line, like, the threshold amount is different. I'm just trying to understand what is the best practice in state government.
Yeah, they're different. Depending on the amount being expended, there are different requirements for authorization. I mean, I certainly think having somebody, having some approval process for expenditures above a certain amount makes sense. I would assume, if there's an expenditure over $5,000 that's not recurring, it's probably something that at least the chair, if not the whole board, should be looking at. To the extent it's a recurring expenditure that is routine and has been approved by the board already, and it's just an annual renewal, I think it's a different.
This is Doug. I disagree a little bit, Josh. And in response to Tom's point, I don't see any real problem with having to approve that once a year, because again, it would remind board members of what we're doing. And once a year is not a big obligation. So I think that I don't think that it's a big obligation if you have to check. If you're going to spend more than $5,000 to renew some activity, that reminds us of the activity and that we're paying so much for it.
So this is Sarah chiming in. I guess my thought on this is that we do approve an operating budget every year, so we will know what those expenditures are. Is that correct? So we do have transparency in reoccurring expenses on an annual basis. Is that a right assumption, or is that not?
Well, this is Doug. Historically, the board has not done a whole lot with looking at our annual budget. Maybe I was asleep, but my memory is that we don't spend a lot of time delving into those. So that's one reason why it's good to be able to be reminded of what's going on. But I don't feel strongly about this, so I'll let you guys do whatever you like.
I mean, I will be honest. Here's my thought on this. I do think that we need to have a threshold amount. I do think it's good to, like, look at, especially non-reoccurring, especially if we're looking at a budget annually anyway. I don't know if there is an amendment that we can make right on the fly right now to address this, because I don't want these rules to be too taxing on staff when it's not necessary. But I do think a level of accountability and transparency is appropriate. So I guess my question is this something that maybe we come back, or is there a way to amend it right now that works for everybody?
Well, just Doug, if you want to amend it, and I would support it, of putting in the words non-reoccurring, that's okay with me. And if that makes the staff happy, that's good.
Sarah, was there an answer to your question, I mean, about how the budget approval process works? Are these non-recurring costs things that would be approved in the annual or in the budget?
Yes, Jonathan, not necessarily. I mean, for example, we could have a due diligence expense for venture capital that exceeded $5,000 but was non-recurring. We certainly went through that process with that. If you just put after payroll, comma, non-recurring, it probably would be an amendment that would make it easy to work with.
Are the recurring obligations, like the Bloomberg subscription you mentioned, are those part of the budget?
That would be a recurring obligation, and it's part of our appropriation annually approved by the board.
Okay, so
this is Doug.
Let me explain one thing on that. Excuse me. The first time that the Bloomberg terminal comes up, the first time we subscribed to it was just about a year ago. Of course, then that would be a non-recurring initial and would be subject to board notice and approval. Then after that, it goes into the budget or goes into the appropriation.
This is Doug. For a little history, for the two of you. Since we adopted this, I can only remember two or three times when it's happened. So we're not talking about a very big deal here.
That's correct.
If it's that rare, I'd sort of be inclined to keep it, but I don't have a strong view either.
I mean, if we leave it like it is, the only reoccurring item we know about is the one we've talked about, and it would be pretty easy for them to get that approved every year.
I mean, I will be honest. If this doesn't seem to cause unnecessary burden on staff that impacts our ability to be an effective and efficient organization, I'm inclined to just keep it. I just, at the end of the day, want to make sure that we do have some sort of threshold. We do have some sort of level of accountability. If this seems to have worked, that's fine. But if there's a way to ensure that we optimize operations because it's been hindrance, then I'm open to suggestions. So it seems like the board is okay with this policy as written, and if staff feedback is that this is okay based on the couple years that it's been enacted, then I guess we can keep it. I guess I'm just in this discussion just trying to make sure that we have at least some additional information if we need to make a decision or a change that we do so now.
There's a couple different ways of looking at that threshold. The first one is, well, what is this number in relation to our overall appropriation? And if you look at that, you're talking about something that's less than 0.4% of our total appropriation, and that seems a bit small. But there's another way of looking at it and saying, okay, where is this number with respect to a procurement threshold? And the procurement rules for the state change depending upon how high you're going. By the time you get 25,000, you have to jump through a very different set of rules for procurement. At 5,000, you're still dealing with a simplified bid process. So one of the reasons for keeping it would be kind of sending the notice to staff saying, you know, okay, folks, if you're going to spend that much, remember you should be going through the simplified bid process. But the reason for not doing it would be that the total number is so small compared to your overall appropriation. That's my question.
Yeah, this is Doug. If I can chime in, as I said before, it almost never happens. So I think we're beating a very live horse here. So I would suggest we just leave it and move on.
So can you make a motion, please, Doug?
Do we need a motion to do that? I don't think so. We can just do nothing and it stays.
All right, so I guess we're going to leave this then because we don't need to do anything. It's as is. Okay. All right, so then we'll keep this one. The second one is that the commissioners must approve out-of-state travel for the executive secretary, staff, and commissioners. Can somebody give us a little bit of history on this?
Okay, this is Doug. I lived through this. And it directly affected me. A previous commissioner was very much against spending money for almost anything, and so that commissioner focused in on travel, and this was a way of trying to limit the ability of people to go to meetings, whether it's Tom and Rich who go to Chicago to a meeting, or whether I went to a state land commissioner's meeting. I used to attend those meetings fairly regularly and represent the state. And the commissioner who made this motion didn't like that, so he wanted to stop as much travel as possible. So that's the history of it.
Does this rule create practical problems?
I believe it does. This is Tom. There are times in northern Wisconsin where Highway 2 straddles the Wisconsin-Michigan border. And if you're going from one place in Wisconsin to another, you may end up in Michigan and in violation of this policy. Again, because it was just drafted so broadly. If you're going to leave number 3 in place, that you're saying, well, we can't spend more than $5,000 without getting board chair approval, I think that's going to cover virtually all the expensive out-of-state travel that could occur. And if it's going to be less expensive, it seems like that should fall within the discretion of the executive secretary.
Yeah, I would also be okay with, instead of having the commissioners approve, having the board chair approve, or would that be problematic as well?
So just to be clear, the example Tom gave is kind of an interesting one, and what he says makes sense. It's kind of unique. The big issue and why this was adopted was to stop me, for example, of going to Colorado or going to New Mexico to attend a Western State Land Commission meeting. And it effectively stopped me from doing that, but we have not gone to those meetings very often anymore. So if we eliminate this, that would mean that if I or Josh or Sarah or Tom or anyone wanted to attend one of those meetings, that if it was more than 5,000, which it very likely would be, then that could be approved by the board chair without the other commissioners knowing about it. Is that a problem? I don't know.
So this is Sarah. I'm just going to chime in quickly. I guess from my perspective, this policy just seems to not be in practice with the rest of the state. I don't know how many other agencies have to get approval for out-of-state travel. I mean, at the end of the day, my concern is making sure that we are doing travel that aligns with policy, which we've got that covered because we're not going to be doing things that don't align with policy. And the other piece of it is expense. We don't want these extravagant trips being necessarily encumbered upon, and that's already covered in our board expenditure piece. So knowing that we've got the policy side covered and we've got the expense side covered, do we need to add another layer that is that really necessary at the end of the day? I'm inclined to say no, because we've got it covered, and we also have, it's not right now necessarily a practice that other state agencies are doing. So that's kind of my thought, is I don't really think that this is necessary, but I guess, again, I'm open if people do have strong feelings one way or the other.
So this is Josh. A couple things I'll note. One is, I mean, $5,000 is an awfully expensive trip. So, you know, I'm not sure that would necessarily cover everything. That being said, you know, having the executive secretary approve travel certainly seems appropriate to me. I might have travel of the executive secretary approved by the chair or something like that. So there's always an independent approver. But I'm comfortable with something along those lines.
Ms. Jonathan, I agree with you, Josh. What we do is we provide the board approves our appropriation. We have to live within it annually. Beyond that, I would be happy to provide a travel plan to the board chair on a regular basis. And then the board chair, if he or she did not like it, would say, well, I want you to pull back on that. But we do try and live within our means, and have been constraining the number of people that like to go to conferences. But there are some that are critically important, like sending Mike Krieger off to San Diego has proved its value to us. And my goodness, he's redoing our entire software for loan management very, very inexpensively compared to the hundreds of thousands of dollars it would otherwise cost to buy something new. That's the kind of example of value we get.
So this is Sarah. So I'm going to make a motion that we revise this policy based on feedback given by Josh and Doug, which will be that the executive secretary will approve out-of-state travel, and then out-of-state travel for the executive secretary can be approved by the board chair. If that seems to be the feedback. So if we can just maybe at our next meeting come back with something and we can approve it, does that work for everybody?
Well, we can't discuss this now until there's a second, so I'll second it. And now to discuss it, I disagree. I think we can just eliminate this completely, because the other policy says the board chair shall approve expenses more than $5,000. So if the executive secretary wants to go somewhere and it's more than $5,000, the board chair would have to approve it. So I guess the executive secretary could sneakily go places for $4,500 without the board chair approving it, but I don't think that's about to happen.
Well, Doug, the way I would interpret that is that we would be, if we had two or three people going to a conference that cost more than $5,000, that would qualify for informing the board chair.
So, Sarah, explain to me what your motion is trying to do, please. Thank you.
Basically, my motion is that the BCPL staff will come back with revised language around this policy that will incorporate feedback. So the feedback has been given about that the out-of-state travel is approved by the executive secretary for staff, and that there might be some sort of connection with out-of-state travel by the executive secretary to be approved or reviewed by the chair. But that they take this feedback, looking at this discussion, and come back with a proposal at the next meeting.
Yeah, I guess I just don't think we need any discussion of out-of-state travel versus general agency expenditures, which are dealt with in the last thing we discussed.
Just Jonathan, we'd be happy to work with you, Sarah, on a revised language based on this discussion and then bring it back to the board.
That's fine with me.
Okay. So it's been seconded. So all those in favor with taking this feedback, having the BCPL staff come back and come up with a potential revised proposal, say aye.
Aye, Josh.
So, okay, I can't
aye, Sarah.
I vote aye.
Great. So it's moved, so we will bring this back at the next board meeting.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood you, Sarah. I'm sorry. I thought your motion was to change this policy in some way, but I misheard you. So your motion was to have the staff look at it, and that's fine with me, and that's what we voted on, apparently. Thank you.
Yeah, and they'll come back with revised language. Great. Okay, so then the last item is to prohibit board staff from lobbying the state legislature, governor's office, or the federal government on proposals unless approved by the board. Any feedback from the BCPL team that they want to share?
Could I make a comment? This is Jonathan. Could I make a comment on that?
Sure.
I feel pretty strongly that this provision in its form should be repealed. We never cut new ground from what a board policy that's been adopted is or what we understand the board's position to be. But if I'm asked by a legislator, what does X, Y, and Z draft bill portend for BCPL, I want to be able to answer the question. And this thing was designed by a previous board member to just gummy up the works and prevent staff from discussing any items that particular board member wanted to dream up with other legislators that might ask a question. So it's like a muzzle, and I think it's unnecessary.
Well, this is Doug. I agree with Jonathan about the motivation here, but what the example you just gave and other examples where the staff has asked questions about the impact of something, that isn't lobbying. This only talks about lobbying, which says please vote yes or please vote no. And as long as you don't lobby, you can discuss the impacts as much as you like, I think. Maybe you should clarify that for me, Jonathan.
Well, maybe Tom could address that. We both ran into this issue.
The previous board took a very expansive view of the word lobbying. And in essence, one of the commissioners took the view that any discussion with any sitting legislator was lobbying. And because of
that's ridiculous.
I know, but I'm just because of the speed with which legislation moved in the last session, bills would be introduced, a hearing would be scheduled, and a hearing would be held all within a couple days. And so in situations like that where we would have to very quickly determine, how does this play out? There may or may not be a board meeting in between there.
Well, this is Doug. I hope I'm not being picky, but like I said a minute ago, any discussion of the impact to Fulford would be okay. And then if the board decided we wish to take a position for or against the piece of legislation, then we might have to have an emergency meeting, and the board would have to decide if we wanted to take a position and then actually lobby for or against that particular piece of legislation or that policy. It could be a policy of some agency. And that's kind of how things should work, I think. But tell me if I'm wrong.
The distinction that I saw on this last go-around is if a bill would be introduced that on its face would appear to cost the trust funds, pick a number, $1 million a year, that was as far as we could go. We could say it appears from the face of this legislation that this would divert $1 million a year from the Common School Fund. We could not actually take the next step and say, and that would harm the trust funds and the beneficiaries.
But you could come to the board and ask our approval.
So it sounds like, this is Josh, we're all in agreement. Well, I guess Sarah hasn't weighed in, so we should wait. But I suspect we're all in agreement that the staff should be able to provide information relevant to any bill about BCPL, the impact on BCPL from any legislation, but that if a formal position is going to be taken on legislation in support or opposed, we think that the board probably ought to vote before a formal position is taken. Are we all on the same page about that?
Josh, this is Sarah. I mean, I'm kind of chewing on what this should be. I think that your summary is accurate. I mean, I just look at this from, like, my corporate boards that I have sat on. I mean, on a corporate board, like, the CEO or the staff would never talk to investors or benefactors. If the board was different than what the staff was doing, that would be a clear problem. And if that's happening, then we've got problems. So I'm just trying to think through. We want to make sure that doesn't happen, because if the board is advocating one way and staff is doing something else, then that's clearly that's a huge problem. I don't want to stop staff from being honest, but I also want to make sure that we are always coordinating in a way that we are one team, one fight. And so I guess I'm just trying to think through, like, what is that? Do we need a policy to ensure coordination and that we're advocating in unison? Or, you know, I don't want people to not feel like they can't be honest. I mean, so this is where I'm just trying to kind of think through what this is, to be honest.
I mean, my view is that the BCPL staff should always be able to give their honest feedback to any, you know, government officials or public people in the public who ask about the impact that any policy would have on the BCPL. And it sounds like we may want to figure out exactly, you know, how to balance the concerns that have been raised in another meeting.
You know, Josh, this is Jonathan. I serve at the pleasure of the board. If we're cutting new ground and violating your understanding of where we should be, I should be gone. Meaning, then my responsibility is to keep the staff in line and all of us in concert together. And so I don't see a need for this provision in practice. But if we want to hold it off for another meeting and again, worry it a little bit, I don't use the word worry, but work it a little bit, that'd be fine with me as well. We just do not cut new ground. And if it's a budget that the governor's introduced, we're not going to lobby in favor of it unless the board's supporting it, for example.
Yeah, this is Doug. I guess the problem I see from this discussion and having lived through this is kind of the definition of lobbying. And I guess I think lobbying has a very narrow definition, namely to be pushing for or against a certain policy. To use Tom's example a moment ago, if something is introduced that's going to have an impact of $1 million, and I think we can go say that. I mean, the staff can, without the board's permission, you can say, this will have a negative impact of $1 million on our trust fund. Now, you're obviously saying you don't like that. You haven't said, therefore, please vote no. And as long as we believe in that distinction, I don't see why the staff would have any problem, as Sarah pointed out, telling the truth about any of these impacts. And then if the bill or the policy were to be moving forward, as Josh sort of said, the board could quickly at the next meeting, even an emergency meeting, vote against that policy, hopefully 3-0, and then at that point, Jonathan could go back and say, the board has taken a strong position against this. That's how I think things probably should work.
So I guess I'm just trying to think through, like, what's our action here, right? Do we want the staff to come back with recommendations? Do we want to table this? I mean, like, what do we, what's our action
I guess what I'm saying is I think it's okay the way it is, as long as somebody doesn't get real ridiculous about the word lobbying.
It sounds like that the staff is concerned based on prior experience about what that means, though.
I'm with you, Josh. Yep.
So my inclination would be to get rid of it, the policy, and subject to the understanding that if BCPL is taking a formal position on something in favor or opposed, we should have a vote first among the commissioners.
So it sounds like maybe let's have the staff look at this and then come back. Because I think, Josh, to your point, the staff does have some concerns about it. So to Doug's point, he thinks it's fine. Let's just make sure we come up then with a happy medium that ensures we cover our bases. And there also seems to be some, like, different interpretations of how this is even read, and we could spend hours discussing those interpretations. That's why I also think it might be valuable to come back, and so we're clear on what this means.
Okay. This is Jonathan. I'm okay with that. Just so you know, like, when a bill comes up, like the bill that eliminated third-party audits last year, I went to legislators and said, look, this is going to cost the Board of Commissioners trust funds money. We can't quite quantify it, but my board has not taken a position on it. I'm just telling you that this is damaging from our staff viewpoint. So I always differentiate between a board position and staff's assessment of legislation, if that's helpful.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said a few minutes ago.
All right, so is there a motion on the table?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't remember one.
Does somebody want to make a motion?
Do we need one, or can the staff just for our next meeting make suggestions or for consideration?
I think that's a great idea, Josh. I think the staff can just make recommendations at our next meeting.
We can do that.
What I'd like the staff to do is explain to us why it's a problem. If you, as I have outlined, and Jonathan just said, he can tell people everything he wants to tell them about the impact as long as he doesn't say the board has taken the position, unless we have. And then if we have, he can say that as well. That seems workable. But at the next meeting, they can explain to us why that's not workable if they think it's not.
I will be happy to do that, Doug, at the next meeting. I will give you one anecdote. I went to a meeting with some legislators' staff and pointed out some flaws in the bill that they were proposing for their boss. That boss then called the board chair and complained that we were lobbying against the bill. And I was not lobbying it per se, but I was now telling him this thing isn't workable. So it is a tricky spot to be in as staff sometimes.
And again, if you if you have ridiculous, uninformed legislators, I don't care about people's names, then this could happen, and the board chair has to just say, listen, the staff wasn't lobbying, we buy information, so cool it.
So I'm just sensitive about time. We're 5 minutes over. So if it's okay, the recommendation was just to move forward. We'll look at this last policy, and the board will come back with any recommendations and additional feedback and clarifications around what this means. Does that work with the other two commissioners?
Yep, that's fine.
Yes.
Wonderful. All right, so we have then moved beyond new business. So routine business is, Jonathan, your update. So any about the kind of report, yep, do you want to share on that?
Actually, I don't think there's necessary anymore. There are three attachments to the end of this packet relative to bond purchases, transaction reports, and I think if there are any questions on that, I'll be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I don't have a report. This meeting's gone on a little bit longer than it should, perhaps, if I were to speak more.
Okay, Jonathan, I have one question for you, sort of. There was some discussion at one time of the board doing some informational meetings with new legislators and new legislator staff. I'd be curious what the progress is of doing that, because I think it's important for them to find out who we are and what we do. So what's the status of that idea?
Well, it's still an idea, and we agree that we want to do it. We want to do two things, Doug. We want to have a meeting with staff of the Joint Finance Committee, and because that's really where the leverage is for us, is to let us know what we do. And we would like to host a meeting of new freshman legislators. And we're working with an individual that is familiar with them to that end. But we haven't got it scheduled yet.
Jonathan, Sarah, I think that's a great idea.
I agree. That's why I asked about it.
All right. I know Tom also has two updates for the commissioners.
The biggest one is that the Legislative Audit Bureau has instituted an audit for this fiscal year just recently. it's something that I've been asking for. They had audited us for, I think, 6 or 7 consecutive years, and then they just stopped 2 years ago. So it's a little bit unusual that they would start it out of the blue like this, but nonetheless, it is what it is, and I think it helps with our transparency. The other one is that we're currently working on some potential real estate acquisitions, but there's nothing to report on those at this meeting, just to let you know that we're still working on those.
And then just on my end, two updates is that we're going to talk about kind of our outreach strategy, so we can come back and share that with the group. And then I also did have a very successful and exciting investment committee discussion with as the newest member of that group. And I think we'll be coming back to all of you on some kind of ideas and suggestions we have as we continue to kind of flesh this out. But it was a great meeting, and we're going to be meeting every other week as a committee to kind of go through these opportunities. So just wanted to kind of share that with my fellow commissioners. Any other updates? Okay, is there a motion to adjourn?
I move we adjourn.
I second.
Great, it's been moved and seconded. All those say aye.
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 Aye, great. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, and happy week, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.